Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Utah State University's Digital Folklore Project is out with their Digital Lore of the Year for 2024. If you're curious, the top entrant is Chicago Rat Hole. You probably saw that. Other contenders include How Brits Wash Dishes, Eating Cats and Dogs parodies, and Mudang Baby Hippo memes. Our guests today to talk about this are co-directors of USU's Digital Folklore Project, Jeannie Thomas and Lynn McNeil. We'll also be talking with Afasani Resai, who is on the board of the Digital Folklore Project. And we'd love to hear your candidate for top digital lore of the year. Maybe just your favorite meme or tweet from 2024, and you can reach us at upraccess@gmail.com. So we bring in Jeannie Thomas, professor of English, USU.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for coming in.
I'm happy to be here.
Appreciate you being here. Lynn McNeil, Associate Professor of English and Director of Graduate Studies.
That is correct. Yes. Yeah. Happy 2025.
Good to have you with us. Happy 2025. And joining us this year is Afasani Resai, who's on the board of the Digital Folklore Project, Assistant Professor of English. Thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me.
Remind me, Jeannie, what... kind of your specialty, what you're doing these days?
I do legend studies. Is one of my main areas of legend studies and the supernatural.
All right, yeah. So. And we did some love potions.
We did. I forced Valentine's. You through a lot of love yes. magic rituals.
That was fun.
You were unwilling to have open flame in the studio.
That's right.
I couldn't fault it.
It was smart, but we probably suppressed the love.
Yeah. Which maybe is okay.
Yeah, yeah. So Lynn McNeil, Associate Professor of Folklore in the English Department, Director of Graduate Studies. What's your area of study?
So digital folklore is a big major thing that I study. Also legends as well, and the supernatural a bit. We get some good overlap in our interests. And then folklore in sort of the public media is another thing that I've been writing about a little bit more, trying to figure out how you can be entertaining on television and still remain like a serious scholar.
Yeah, yeah.
Not very easy.
that's great, yes. Yes. And you're going for the number.
The EBS number.
Yes.
Is the Erdos Bacon Sabbath number. Is that small world metric that
right.
you know, tells us we're accomplished not in one field, but in many.
So I think a lot of people are familiar with Kevin Bacon, the degrees of separation from Kevin Bacon.
Yes,
right?
The 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon.
Yeah. There's a similar in math, is that?
Yes, the Erdos Paul Erdos, number? The mathematician. Yep, and then Black Sabbath, the band in the realm of music.
Yeah.
And some clever folks online have combined these into a sort of exponentially better 6 degrees of separation. If you have published with someone who's published with Paul Erdos, if you've been in TV or film with someone who's been with Kevin Bacon, and if you've done a musical performance with someone who has performed with Black Sabbath, you get this coveted magical EBS number.
Yeah, yeah, no, excellent, excellent, very good. We ought to add, I don't know, maybe the Terry Gross number.
Oh, you know. Public radio
really
public radio. Needs
maybe
to
I
run
could,
with
I could
this.
Get in there somehow if you did that. But
yes,
we'll see.
We'll work on this.
We'll work on that. Okay. Afasani Resai, Assistant Professor of English. I assume you study folklore as part of that.
Yes. I study the intersection of folklore, religion, and politics, mostly in the Middle East and the Iranian context. So I look a lot at vernacular culture on the internet. I spend a lot of time going through how people engage with politics and religion in the Middle East and Iranian context. So, so I study rumors, legends, conspiracy narratives, and all sorts of fun things on the internet.
Yeah. So before we jump in here, Jeannie Thomas, and I'll throw this out to everybody. You know, people might think, oh, you know, fine, Tom's having some fun. Let's let him have some fun. But why does this all matter?
Well, first, I mean, we can't just shunt fun aside.
Right.
It's incredibly important that we all have fun. It's how we kind of rinse out our brains, and it's how we reinvigorate ourselves, and it's how we're able to function. So there's a really important psychological role of fun in our lives, and I don't want to underestimate it. And I just want to point out that one of the things I love about doing this project is, like, when I was researching the Chicago rat hole, somebody compared it to fossils, and soon I was reading about trace fossils versus body fossils. I mean, you can learn a tremendous amount of interesting things about the world by paying attention to this stuff. And you certainly learn a huge amount about culture, which is what we swim in and really important.
Yeah. So, Lynn, this year it's a lot of fun and not as much serious. We've had serious before on this,
it's
on
true.
This list.
It's true. You know, this year we made a conscious decision to focus on what we thought maybe could show us a better side of humanity, as opposed to sort of what's become the daily drudgery of politics and serious social issues and all of these things. And of course, those elements are still at the back of a lot of these fun, trivial, kind of frivolous issues, and that's often what keeps them in circulation. Something that seems really unimportant sticks around because in some subtle way it's speaking to something a little bit bigger. So we wanted to zero in on that rather than kind of continue to give coverage to a bunch of stuff that's already getting enough coverage and people kind of need a break.
Yeah. Well, I sure feel that.
Oh, yeah.
So, Senator Say, the studies that you do, that serious things going on, but you're looking at how this manifests, I guess, in the digital world and in culture, right?
Yes. And as Lynn was saying, I think all of these fun things that we've picked are intertwined with social issues. But I agree that really in trying times, humor is something that keeps us sane. So I think it's nice to focus on that instead of amplifying more negative trends that have been going on this year. And we've had a presidential election, which creates a lot of negativity in some way. So we've really tried to pick more positive trends. And yes, and I think it's really important for people anywhere, but especially in the context that I look at, in the contemporary Iranian context, people have to deal with a lot of social restriction, economic issues. So, and I see a lot of humor going around in the Persian-speaking social media, which unfortunately, most of the things that we've picked this year don't really translate out of the English-speaking context. And I was thinking about this the other day. Usually when we have a more visual trend, I can see the same thing happening all across social media, in different languages. I remember the 2020, I think one of our contenders was Bernie Sanders sitting in mittens at the inauguration. And that definitely came up in multiple memes that I saw in the Persian-speaking social media. Bernie Sanders in a market in Tehran or, at a cafe sitting just outside with his mittens. So, but people generate their own, obviously, specific culturally relatable forms of humor in any context. And I think it's really important to look at it and document it and understand it.
So Jean Thomas, remind us how this happens. Digital Folklore Project, has people vote on these?
So actually we made a slight change up this year since we are celebrating our 10th year. And our big question was, this is a heck of a lot of work and it's pretty overwhelming to deal with stuff on the internet. So how do we streamline this and keep this smooth? So we actually went back to our roots and looked at the Oxford English Dictionary Word of the Year process, and we are following their process. They were our inspiration. And so we streamlined it because one of the things we were doing is we were always hassling our judges. So now we have a panel of USU folks voting. So we'll try that for a few years and see how that goes.
All right.
Students and faculty will be able to vote on it, and we're going to give that a shot so then we won't have to hunt down so many people from different parts of the world. The OED is like, we're experts on this, and we've been tracking it, and we have things to say about it. So we were like, let's claim our power, and let's try this. So I think they're good leads to follow. So we track them during the year. We do it month by month. We track trends and memes. But we look for things that are not necessarily high numbers, but that are culturally interesting and that are folklore. And we want to see what they're doing. And then we get together and we sort through all those and we select them and we vote.
All right, well, let's jump in. Digital lore of the year. The top vote getter was Chicago Rat Hole. Gina, tell us what this is.
So this is just a great metaphor for what it's like in everyday life. This is actually an imprint on the concrete in a sidewalk in Chicago of a rat. And it's basically a rat kind of Looney Tunes style face planting in the concrete. And it's this imprint. And an artist, it's been there for a while, but in like 20 years, people in the neighborhood say. But an artist saw it and he made a pilgrimage and filmed his pilgrimage to it in January. So you can be creative in January. It's good to know. He was creative and it blew up on the internet. And it's incredibly folkloric because pilgrimage is a folk thing. And people started creating little spontaneous shrines there for the rat. Some neighbors say it was really a squirrel, that it just looks like a rat in the imprint. And it probably fell from a tree. And then there's hope that it may have lived because there are tracks leading away. But anyway, so that's the backstory. And then they leave money and they pour alcohol in the imprint, and that's the Chicago Rat Hole. Its nickname is Splatatooie.
It does look like a rat fell from height onto this wet cement. I can see how you went down the fossil rabbit hole after this, right? Because it does look like those dinosaur footprint.
Yeah,
that you see.
So somebody tweeted that it's a trace fossil versus a body fossil. So I mean, what a fun way for me to review my geology there and think, oh yeah, what's the difference now? And I spent some fun time Googling that. But yeah, so that's what it is. There's drama too, because after it got popular, and this is kind of indicative of the internet, we find this wonderful thing and then somebody ruins it for us. So they poured poured plaster in it, tried to stop it. And maybe, you know, it was somebody tired of the traffic because it did create a lot of traffic and debris on the sidewalk from people doing their thing with the rat hole. But people chipped it out with like ice scrapers and their license plates. And so they got it out. But then ultimately the city took out the whole thing, the whole section of the sidewalk, and it's in storage. That happened in April. So we had 4 last glorious months for the rat hole. And by the way, that rat paid for the artist's rent who did the original tweet for at least a month.
Yeah, that's something, right? Yeah. I want to play something. Here's just a little bit of, this is a Fox 32 Chicago report. This is a wedding at the rat hole. Let's hear a little bit of this.
Since its rediscovery a couple weeks ago, the Chicago rat hole has brought joy to countless Chicagoans who flocked to the rodent-like impression in a Roscoe Village sidewalk. So you knew it was inevitable, a Chicago rat hole wedding. Wedding bells on Saturday at what's become Chicago's hottest tourist attraction, the Chicago Rat Hole.
Well, I think the rat hole is a gift that keeps on giving.
Raj Sarathy and his wedding planner, Lika Sadokeen, say Raj and his partner looked at a lot of Chicago landmarks for their wedding until 9 days ago when he saw the story of the Chicago Rat Hole.
We were viewing a lot of different venues, a lot of different, you know, big monuments in Chicago, and finally, we looked at each other and we were like, hey, let's get married at the rat hole.
When he came to me with the idea, you know, I was like, okay, that's great. You know, we can make this happen. And they're super enthusiastic about it.
For those who don't know, the rat hole is a rodent-shaped dent in the cement in the 1900s.
So there you go. They got married at the rat hole.
So romantic.
Yeah. Well, yeah. What?
I feel that we need to draw a connection across time here to a 2015 trend that didn't win, but that did make it onto our ballot, which was the similar pilgrimage and shrine to the dead raccoon in Toronto. And it's interesting to see the sort of longevity of these traditions. I don't think anyone got married there. There was maybe less of a hopeful vibe with the Toronto raccoon. There was more of maybe a civic responsibility, an initial tweet that went out to the city saying, hey, there's just a dead raccoon on the sidewalk. When's someone going to come clean this up? And it persisted. And so, as so often happens, people took this into their own hands, grassroots effort. People began highlighting this lack of consideration in the city by building a shrine. Someone put a little framed photo of a living raccoon next to it, like you might see at any altar or gravesite or anything like that. People brought candles, people brought items. And this is actually part of an even bigger tradition of sort of memorializing creatures. There was a famous roach shrine that was built in a university hallway at one time. Again, sort of the playfulness element is covering up a maybe more serious, hey, let's keep our environment clean and free from carcasses of various kinds. But seeing this where it's got that little twist of hope, maybe the rat made it out, you know, gives it that different feel while still tying it to all these other spontaneous shrine traditions.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Sonny, you want to say anything about this?
Sure. Mm-hmm. I was actually looking up the Chicago Rat Hole also last night. And I should admit, I didn't know about this until very late. And I realized it happened in January. I probably learned about it in the late fall. But apparently there is a second picture of a rat hole that has been posted in August, but the location remains undisclosed because people don't want the same, you know, traffic to happen in their neighborhood, apparently. And there was a subreddit on the Chicago, you know, Reddit page, someone pleading people to stop making pilgrimages to the rat hole because it's creating a lot of traffic. And if you see the pictures, people are leaving quite a lot of things at the rat hole. So I assume some of the people who lived on that street may not have been super happy about it, but it was really a really beautiful thing. All the range of things that people were putting there, like sticks of cheese, which we don't even know if it was a rat. There was some, as Jeannie mentioned, there was some debate over whether or not it was a rat or it was a squirrel. But people made up their own mind, I guess, and decided it was a rat. So they left the cheese.
So I have to ask, I ask this often, I guess we talk about these things. What's going on here? It's, people go to the largest ball of twine, and they, you know, it's things that I guess many other people would think, what are you doing? Right? But this obviously has attracted a lot of attention, pilgrimages.
Yeah, I think that my favorite thing about this is the way that the concept of pilgrimage is a scalable idea. Because we can have what we think of with the normal use of that term, a sacred religious journey where you're visiting a site that's maybe renowned worldwide. And then we can take that down to really the tiniest little element of, oh, there's an imprint of a rodent in the concrete and I'm going to make a pilgrimage there. And I think you're onto something connecting this to, you know, world's largest frying pan and giant ball of twine. The sort of idea that the more obscure or small something is, the more of a challenge it is to get there. You know, lots of people make it to Notre Dame. You know, that's a tourist site that lots of people get to. Not everybody has the dedication it takes to sort of rise up, raise the trivial up to that same level and say, I'm going to make an effort to go to this place. And we see roadside attractions. We see entire publications dedicated to, you know, the unique, the off the grid, the unfamiliar in places. And it's a way, I think, to connect to a particular location in a manner that seems more unique or more special than sort of the surface level that other people might hit.
The rat hole has been called Chicago Stonehenge.
So there you
Chicago
go. Stonehenge.
Yes, exactly.
And so before we go to break here, Jeannie, this is in storage now.
Yes.
So undisclosed location, I'm guessing. Yeah. They don't want pilgrimages to the storage unit.
Yeah, the city roads, people have it. So, I mean, enterprising people could probably figure it out, but we are not advocating that here.
Yeah. But Utah State University should surely make an attempt to bring it to the Fife Folklore Archives.
That would be awesome.
Yeah. There you go. Well, we put out the word right here. Well, we're talking about the Digital Folklore Project's Digital Lore of the Year. And we'll be getting, there are five additional listed here. We've just been talking about Chicago Rat Hole. We'll be getting to talk about Scram, Leave Her Alone memes, how Brits watch dishes, eating cats and dogs, legend parodies, mindful and demure memes and Mudeng baby hippo memes. We're talking with Jeannie Thomas and Lynn McNeil, co-directors of the USU Digital Folklore Project and a board member of the project, Afsani Resai. We'll talk more following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking about the Digital Lore of the Year. USU's Digital Folklore Project puts this together every year. We're looking back at 2024, and we're going to get into talking how Brits wash dishes, eating dog, cats, and dogs parodies, Mudeng baby hippo memes. Our guests include co-directors of the project, Jeannie Thomas and Lynn McNeil. We have a board member of the project as well, Afsani Resai. All three are in the USU English department. So we'll turn to you, Afsani Resai. Scram, leave her alone memes.
Yes. So these are the memes that originated from this video that comedian Kel Kripe uploaded under TikTok in September of this year. And I believe we're going to listen to the video.
So yeah, let's hopefully this is a representative or maybe the original. Let's hear this.
Scram! Leave her alone. She doesn't want to talk to you. Scram!
Thank you. And so the original video starts with the phrase, "This is a message for all the guys trying to talk to my girl," which is sometimes cut out of the memes that came after this video. So for the listeners who don't see the video, Kel Kripe is wearing round glasses and a wolf T-shirt, kind of mildly intimidating, addressing the camera and raising their fist in kind of a performative anger and telling, you know, the other guys to not talk to their partner, which kind of, again, gives the impression of that protective slash jealous partner who wants to, you know, make sure their partner doesn't interact with other people and their relationship isn't in jeopardy. But the memes kind of take this almost fully out of the romantic, you know, relationship context and really apply to all sorts of, you know, scenarios that have nothing to do with this dynamic. So some of my favorites are, you know, ibuprofen shouting at a headache to leave someone alone, or crystals telling negative energy to scram, doctors defending their front desk staff. So you see there are all kinds of scenarios. Actually, my favorite, I should say, is the one that says, "How I wish I could respond to every email in my inbox," which I'm pretty sure everyone here can relate to, or my voicemail greeting, which I think works really well. There are also some other examples of kind of that show this theme of protection, like friends protecting each other from potential harassment, for example, in a bar. Or there are a few that I've seen: husbands protecting their wives from their kids and telling the kids to scram and leave their mom alone, which both of these kind of point to some pre-existing patterns about, you know, what women kind of deal with in their everyday lives, both at home and out of the home. So I thought that was an interesting use of this scram, leave her alone content.
Jeannie or Lynn, anything you want to say about scram, leave her alone?
One of the things that I liked about this, and I think we all noticed it, is the word scram. It's a fun word to say, and it's kind of an old-fashioned word. I think of a kind of a 50s cartoon character saying scram.
Yeah.
How many times can I say scram? But and I think that's part of the charm with this, too. And the OED also noticed that there were a lot of old-fashioned words this year. Scram, demure. And another one that came up that they noticed, which I just love, is lore, which is over 1,000 years old. So that's how important this stuff is to us. And that's why it sticks around, because it works for us. So lore is a really old word that's now being updated on the internet. And I've heard my daughter do this with her friends, but like it's refers to people's background. So you'll talk about the lore of the influencer as their background. And like my kids will say, "Oh, we're going to go into deep Maddie lore now," if they want to talk about something from her childhood or something like that. So I like the little bits of retro that are in here, and the little nods to the importance of the past.
Yeah, I, on a far less scholarly note than that, I think one of the things I love about this is just like the low the low energy. I think that's a big part of the appeal of this audio clip and video clip, because it was green screened, which is an interesting new technological development for everyday people to have access to. We can cut out that person and put them in kind of any video we want. But a big part of the charm in my mind is really just it's almost a half-hearted, meek, you know, despite the words and they're on paper, their seeming intensity or severity. It's a real low energy sort of back off. And I think that's something we can all really relate to.
Let's move to the next one. Maybe I can play this as just one example. So and you never know what's going to come around, or that's part of the charm of this. How British people wash dishes is number three on the list here. So here's just a little video of somebody latching onto this. How British people wash dishes.
Hey, what are you doing?
What do you mean? I'm washing the dishes.
But you don't rinse the soap.
No, I just let it drain.
And you wash all the dishes in one tub of water?
Okay, so for some strange reason, a lot of Americans have been tagging me in videos about washing dishes in the UK. So I'm just gonna show you how we do it, right? First of all, fire up liquid. Wait for the bowl to fill. Once the bowl has some soapy water in it, like so, we begin to wash the dishes with our sponge, put it on the draining board, like so. And that, cutlery, got a mug here, put it on the draining board. Am I missing something here? Why are people tagging me in videos washing up? Well, that's how we wash up in the UK. What's so different in America? Why am I getting tagged in these videos? Let me know.
So, Lynn, tell me. So he's, just to set the visual here, he's not just washing them in the sink. He has this little tub that he puts in the sink,
put the
water in.
The washing up bowl, which non-British folks everywhere have recently, it seems, just learned about. And I believe that's Jason Riley, the content creator, and one of the most viral videos about this. And I think on the board, our perception of this was just that it is so wonderfully folkloric. I mean, we're talking about, you know, cultural differences and everyday life and something as basic as the customs of cleaning and household chores and things like that. And the level of absolute panic that everyone had in response to this just really highlights how even the most mundane things can just carry so much weight. So we saw not just this video, but a series of them of British people illustrating this process of getting the washing up tub. It's a separate bowl. You fill it with water. It's probably great for water conservation. You put the dish soap in it. You scrub your dishes. You sort of shake them off a little bit and you stick them in the drying rack.
No rinsing.
The key, step that every person, I mean, we're talking millions of people in response are just going, wait, how does the soap get off the dishes? And if you look at the explanations, it's funny, the overwhelming majority seems to think it just sort of drips off on the drying rack and then the dishes are clean at the end. There are, I should note, a number of British dissenters who themselves are like, no, we rinse our dishes, don't worry. But everyone has weighed in on this. Scientists have come in to talk about whether or not the bacteria is going to dry on the dishes. People have done deep dives into the ingredients of dish soap and will it harm you to be eating the residue of the dried dish soap that's still on your dishes. Interestingly, science, for what it's worth, seems to come down on the side of you should be rinsing your dishes. Get the soap off, get the last bits of food off. That's generally a good way to do it. But I don't want to cause a culture war here by saying that you know, science is right on this one, because it could be that people just are really dedicated to their way of doing this. That we see some classic sort of what folklorists would call blason populaire, you know, kind of jokes from one group to another, where some people are saying, oh, we finally figured out, you know, what the British use to flavor their food. It's dish soap.
Dish soap,
playing into the well-known stereotype of bland cuisine coming out of the UK. But it really, the out-of-scale reaction of people just aghast, I will never visit the UK. I will throw up the minute I try and eat food there. I mean, it was so hilariously over the top. And I think what we see there is sort of the way that we are siloed in our everyday lives. I don't know that I spent a lot of time thinking that people wash dishes differently in different places. I imagine that's the same for a lot of people. So this really key step of rinsing, you know, people are replying saying, do you rinse shampoo out of your hair or do you just leave it there? You know, kind of the assumed obviousness of the rinse step really just became this cultural touchstone. And it was wonderful.
It's and things you wouldn't know, right?
Yeah.
I don't know if we might next we might have something from Iran. I don't know how they do the dishes there.
I was thinking about this and trying to remember how I did dishes when I was a kid, which didn't happen quite a lot, I should admit. and now I'm guilty of using the dishwasher. But I think people had a similar sense of, you know, conserving water being important, but we did rinse the dishes. So
yeah.
I would create that tub of water in the sink and try to, you know, scrub the dishes, and then I would rinse them and put them back. But the tap was always shut during this whole process. So again, you can, I assume, be conserving water, but also still rinse the dishes. I don't know. But I think British people would argue that we've been ingesting these small amounts of dish soap all this time and we're fine. So it's probably not a big deal. I don't know the science behind it. I think Lynn has looked into it more. But yes, so it is definitely a very interesting, you know, difference in folk culture that you don't really think about. And the videos that we see on TikTok, mostly people are like, I've always done this. Like, this is the only way I know how to do dishes. What are you talking about? This is like, how else could you do dishes? So it really speaks to that quality of folk culture that is embodied and ingrained in our, you know, everyday behavior and routine. And we don't really give it any conscious thought until someone brings it to our attention that, oh, this is not, I don't want to use the word normal because normal looks different to different people, but just, you know, bringing up the differences is when you realize, oh, this is not the way everyone does this, but it's part of my folklore. So
yeah. Well, Ginny, you probably have this with every new couple, right? You're,
yeah,
you know, this is how we do things in my house, this is how we did things in my house, and you have to combine that, you know, for one thing.
Yeah, usually the big fight is over Christmas Eve or something like
yeah,
that. But
yeah,
it is over how you vacuum or how you do.
Yeah.
So housework is definitely a folk learned process. And so it's very folkloric. This one raised a personal experience narrative for me. And that was when I was in college. I had this darling roommate. She's very clean and tidy, very healthy. She was an Aggieette. And she ended up with a bad case of diarrhea. And she could not get it to go away. So she finally goes to the doctor. And the doctor says, you guys probably aren't washing the soap off, rinsing the soap off your dishes. So that always made a huge impact on me. And I like hose my dishes down. So when I saw all these TikToks, I am dying. And like, I'm like, do I just lose my entire faith in the American medical system?
Or, yeah,
you know, I mean, how do I deal with this? It rocked my world. The other thing that I really liked about this one is I saw TikToks in which they look at British television and the ads for dishwashing soap, which just show them with these giant globs of soap bubbles, just these dishes just, it's awful, sliding off and sitting there. And I learned that they call the dishwashing soap, a common dishwashing soap, fairy liquid, which I love. I'm like, why can't we have fairy liquids? Because it's Procter & Gamble, so it's an American-based company. And it turns out it's basically Dawn dishwashing liquid, but they get the more folkloric name. I just felt, you know, wronged all the way around with this one.
Well, let's move to the only political one here, Lynn. Eating cats and dogs. Let me just play that. Of course, we're all familiar with this, I think. Donald Trump, who's our president-elect, in the debate, he brought this up. Small town in Ohio, I think, right?
Yes, Springfield, Ohio.
Springfield, Ohio. And the legend, not proved at all,
and
is that
disproved.
Haitian immigrants were eating cats and dogs. So this has become memes and videos. Here's Eating the Dogs remix from Habitually Henry on YouTube.
Eating the cats, eat the cat, eat the cat. They're eating the dogs, they're eating the cats, eat the cat, eat the cat. Eat the They're cat. Eating the cats. They're eating the dogs. Eat the cat. 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 Eat the They're cat. Eating the dogs. They're eating the cats. Eat the cat.
ABC News did reach out to the city manager there. He told us there have been no credible reports of specific claims of pets being harmed, injured, or abused by individuals within the immigrant community. Let me just say here, this is the
people on television. My dog was taken and used for food. So
the first part of the video, you have dogs and cats looking nervous, right? And then under the report of there's no proof of this, you have famous people rolling their eyes.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's just one of the many.
Oh, man.
So tell us about this.
Yeah, I think we officially gave this a dishonorable mention is what we called it, because there's no way we couldn't address this. This is a classic. I mean, it's like definitionally perfect example of an urban legend or a contemporary legend, including the fact that it has been around for a really long time. This claim of the eating of pets, the eating of animals that we don't consider to be food animals, is one of the main sort of xenophobic themes of legends that crop up about people who have immigrated here. And if we go back to the 1800s, we can actually see the target of this exact legend, people eating other people's pets, was aimed at German immigrants who were culturally, in a lot of ways, sausage makers. There's even folk songs about this, about people putting their neighbors' cats and dogs into the sausages that they're making, German immigrants specifically. So we can see again that ongoing pattern of tradition that just updates itself for what the context is now. There is a Haitian immigrant population in Springfield, Ohio. The tensions that has caused has expressed itself in this incredibly old-fashioned story, this story that has been told in the 1980s about Asian immigrants, in the 1800s about German immigrants. And it's led not just to the story, but, Tom, as you just illustrated for us, to this explosion of artistic creativity. People writing songs. Just as an aside, sometimes I'm depressed by how talented people are on the internet, and I think, I will never be that good at mixing music. Anyways, not that I've tried. But another thing we saw with this was a huge explosion of the use of AI art so that people could create the imagery they wanted. So we saw a lot of pictures of Donald Trump sheltering, you know, large-eyed, nervous-looking cats and dogs and even ducks and birds and kind of becoming this protector of the natural world. And as with so many things on the internet, it's really hard to tell whether those images are in earnest or facetious. And the reality is it's both. If you're a Donald Trump supporter, you see those images and you're like, that's right, this guy's looking out for us and our pets. And if you are not a Donald Trump supporter, you're like, this is a hilarious joke because he is so misguided in these statements that he's making. So we see the same images making arguments on completely opposite sides of the political spectrum.
Jeannie F. Sunny, anything you want to say about this one?
Earliest one that I could find, 1883, Chinese journalist offers $500, which is about $14,000 in our money today, for somebody being actually able to provide proof of this xenophobic legend.
Yeah, so it goes back even that, probably further than that, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Again, speaking of proof, I know it's been, you know, disproven, but even if, let's assume, someone has eaten a cat and they're from Haitian descent, it's just the matter is, as our colleague Tom Mold was saying recently in a lecture, is a matter of whether or not that is generalizable to an entire population of Haitians and, you know, by extension, all immigrants. And I was kind of, as we were talking, I was drawing comparison to the British way of, you know, washing dishes. And even if people are like, you know, terrified and appalled by that, it doesn't end in anti-British policies. Mm. But when we have, you know, different groups of people, you know, supposedly doing things that we don't approve of, which, again, they're not true. But even if they were, it doesn't mean that we have to generalize that sentiment to an entire group of, you know, immigrant population. So, but yeah, the songs... are very catchy, I should say. I wish there was a better, you know, backstory to it, but they're very interesting TikToks that came out of this.
And the original post that kicked this all off to Facebook was just so classically friend of a friend. It was, you know, my neighbor's daughter. And that friend of a friend model is one of the ways that folklorists know something has come to us from the oral tradition. It's been described as sort of the rhetorically perfect situation where it's close enough to seem believable, but distant enough to not be checked up on. So you're not going to go find your neighbor's daughter's hairdresser or whoever told you this, but you absolutely believe that's a real person. And that just, it, as a genre of folklore, we really couldn't overlook this one.
Let's take another break. We'll come back and do the last two. Mindful and Demure Memes and Mudang, Baby Hippo, which Mudang made it to Saturday Night Live. I noticed it.
She did.
Yeah. We're counting down the digital lore of the year for 2024 from the USU Digital Folklore Project. We're talking with Lynn McNeil, Jeannie Thomas, and Afsani Rasai, all from the USU English Department. We'll have more following this break. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Jeannie Thomas, Lynn McNeil, and Afsani Rasai, all from the USU English Department. They're all involved with the USU Digital Folklore Project, and we're talking about the list of the digital lore of the year for 2024. And let's turn next to Mindful and Demure Memes. I admit, Afsani Rasai, I've totally missed this one. But I did pull it up this morning. I don't know. Should we play this little video or?
Partly, maybe a few seconds.
Okay. Nice. All right.
Makeup for work? Very demure, very mindful. I don't come to work with a green cut crease. I don't look like a clown when I go to work. I don't do too much. I'm very mindful while I'm at work. See how.
Mindful and demure are the words she's saying.
So I was going to say, probably everyone has heard it at this point, but apparently not. So,
I'm kidding.
It's the nature of TikTok, really. If you know, you just get fed very, you know, specific content. So it's.
Well, in my case, I'm incredibly old, and I'm not on TikTok. So. That's why it didn't get to me. So anyway.
Yeah. So this trend is. It's one of the ones that I really like, partly because of the return of the word demure, like the return of the scram. But the way that it's returned is somewhat different. Traditionally, I would say demure is used to refer to someone, especially a woman, who's kind of modest and shy and meek, you know, soft-spoken. But this is kind of a satirical commentary on that, and it's interesting, like everyone's still trying to figure out what demure actually is. And someone, I was looking at some of the videos this morning, and someone put in a comment that the meaning of demure changes day by day, hour by hour, and I think it's kind of true, but in general I think it's come to represent the way that people should behave respectfully in any given context. And being mindful is not just about like an internal sense of mindfulness, being mindful of other people's spaces, needs. So the way that the meme is being applied to different situations is like how to shop demurely at Costco, which is a very good thing to learn, like putting your cart aside when you're looking at something or grabbing one sample and quickly walking away. So the video, just to give a quick background, was uploaded by Jules LeBron, who describes herself as a Black Puerto Rican trans woman beauty influencer from Chicago. And she was a cashier at a store, a grocery store, and she had this very short 30-minute break. She was sitting in her car, and she decided to, you know, record this video of herself saying, see how I come to work. You know, even though I'm a beauty influencer, I don't do too much. I'm just, you know, trying to get my job done and go home. So, and the... It really caught fire, like, very quickly. She had a second video a couple days after, and I think it has 30 million views at this point. And it was named by TikTok as their top trend of the year, I think. As I said, it's been used by ordinary people, by celebrities, have, you know, used it in their product, you know, ads. It's been used in political, you know, campaigns. There's a very popular dog version of it, again, because my dog has a TikTok account. I see a lot of this content. So the dog version basically says, see how I give my paw or see how I wait for my food. Very demure, very mindful. I'm not like you other dogs. I don't jump on my, you know, mom and things like that. This return of the word demure in this context is really interesting to note. And even though it's kind of technically presents this idealized femininity, it's being reclaimed by Jules LeBron, who's a trans woman, and is kind of reclaiming this words that might be used or weaponized against trans women to indicate that, you know, they're not woman enough. So, but again, the memes really take it in very different directions. And there are so many ways of being demure in different contexts that we could talk about, but I'd love to hear what others think of it.
Yeah.
I just happened to look up what's our earliest usage of the word demure? And it was 1377. So apparently people have been confused by that word for quite a while now.
Yep. I think it's great as a commentary on influencer culture, this idea that it would be novel that you might go into a public or commercial space and be mindful of other people or demure in your demeanor. I think influencer culture, we now associate with people making a scene, being loud, drawing attention to themselves, causing chaos in a public space, all for the views, you know, all for the likes. And this, I think it's great we kind of circled all the way back around to, you can actually just sort of be quiet and polite.
Well, let's make sure we get the last one in here. Mudeng, baby hippo. So let me just play a video. The caption is, Mudeng does not want a bath. And Mudeng is a baby hippo, a small
pygmy,
yes. Pygmy hippo. So let's hear this. So there's no narration there, so I'll just cut that short. But Mudeng definitely does not want her bath.
No. I think it's important to note, too, that we were discussing this before we got on the air. The U.S. now has its own baby pygmy hippo in Virginia. She was just born, and apparently there is a contest to name her. So for anyone really into their baby pygmy hippos, there's a new one.
Very good. What do you want to say about this, Jeannie?
Mudeng has a special sparky personality. She's often angry. She's often hungry. She often appears to scream kind of silently. She bites her zookeeper regularly. And she's super chonky. So she's very relatable. We all like
totally.
That. We all like that phase in life where we were allowed to tantrum and kind of get away with it, trying to socialize her, trying to get her used to her zookeeper so they can handle her. But she had that spunky personality, which made her stand out from her siblings. And she was also very shiny because of something that is actually called blood sweat. That makes them shiny.
Wow.
It's red and it's their sunscreen, but that's why they're so appealingly shiny.
Wow.
Boy.
And the thing I loved is in this year's group, we kind of did the whole life cycle. You can start off with those baby years when you can get away with screaming and crying and having tantrums. And then those adult years when you face plant on the concrete and are just glad to be able to crawl away.
The life cycle. Yeah, there you go. This is, Gina, this is really hit in there, or Lynn, excuse me. And there are memes, I guess.
Everywhere,
yeah.
Yes, again, my favorites are, again, work-related, I'm sorry. Like, there's a meme of Mudeng, like, silently screaming, and the caption is, "This is how your email finds me." or Mudeng trying to bite the zookeeper's knee. The zookeeper is Monday, and Mudeng is me. So you can imagine. Or me under pressure, in general. Again, Mudeng screaming silently, I think, represents all of us.
Yeah, and the internet loves nothing more than a cute animal, and especially a cute unusual animal. We see a lot of possums, a lot of capybaras, a lot of pygmy hippos populating axolotls on the internet. There's sort of this intense cuteness factor that comes into play that I think really does tap into that sort of fun escapist element that we can't overlook as an important thing in and of itself, regardless of whether or not there's a really kind of like serious social message behind it.
Well, we've reached the end of our time. We've got it all six in. That's good. This is the list made by USU's Digital Folklore Project of the Digital Lore of the Year for 2024. And you can comment, get me an email to upraccess@gmail.com, upraccess@gmail.com. Let me know what you think and what's your favorite meme or tweet from 2024. We've been talking with Lynn McNeil and Jeannie Thomas, co-directors of the USU Digital Folklore Project, and Afsane Resai, who is a board member of the project, all with the USU English Department. Thanks, everyone, for coming in.
Thank you.
And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah. Happy 2025.